find the life you were meant to have. This is All the Way In Radio. I'm your host, Deborah E. Lake, and I'm here to help you recognize, claim, and live fully in your life. It's easy to find people who will tell you you can't. But success and happiness only come when we reject you can't and fully embrace I can. The philosophical foundation for All the Way In can be summed up in the advice of my father, who told me to let the words of my critics roll away like water from a duck's back. So clear your mind and open your heart. Enjoy me. You'll be glad you did. Hello. Welcome to All the Way In Radio. I'm your host, Deborah E. Lake, and I'm glad you're with us today. It's Friday, November the 6th, and we are in our second of a six-part series of HIV/AIDS interviews. Now, today we were supposed to have Thomas DeLorenzo, but he is either running a little late or won't be able to be with us today. So what I am going to do instead is talk about some of the things that were raised in the first show, specifically around isolation. Because part of what I did when I made this show and decided to invite particular people to come on, and Thomas, I hope you're well, because I know how excited you were about being with us today. So I hope you are well, and I look forward to talking with you at a later date. I picked each person because they had something specific to say, and I think that Thomas had a very important story to tell, and I hope you get to hear him again soon. He talks about HIV, and that's one of the things that we have trouble doing. In San Francisco, just today, the New York Times has a story about the fact that there are pockets in San Francisco, neighborhood pockets, where the spread of HIV is running higher than in other places. And they're wondering about how to first identify the pockets and then address why the messages are not getting out about prevention and things like that. And this is my guess, but my educated guess says that the pockets where HIV is spreading the most and the quickest, not necessarily just in San Francisco, but wherever, are the same pockets where we have the most difficulty talking about controversial issues and subjects and topics. And I was excited about having Thomas because he leads the way and led the way for a long time in having these types of conversations. So I will have it without him. And one of the things that I have found as I wrote and was being prepared for my first book, Your Neighbor Has AIDS, was how difficult it is to talk about the things that hurt us, regardless of whether it's HIV or domestic violence or any type of illness that we might have, or being afraid, or child abuse. We have trouble talking about it. And the closer the people are to us, the more we have trouble. Sometimes we find it easier to talk to strangers than to the people who are most in our lives. And with HIV, there becomes a stigma that contributes to our inability to talk about this particular issue. And the stigma is still here. And one way to stop and kill off the stigma is to find ways to talk. And one of the things that I have learned, and I address it in my book, is a lot of times when we're around the dinner table or sitting in the living room or in our dens or in our theater rooms or whatever we call it, watching television or a movie, and we make comments about particular parts of the country or particular people or different states, we never know who's listening among the people that we love. Because over and over, when I have sat with people who are struggling with first finding out that they have HIV, and how do I tell, who do I tell, and deciding not to tell, one of the biggest reasons that they decide not to tell and not to share and not to access the resources that are right there in their families and in their churches and in their neighborhoods sometimes is because of what they've heard, how they've heard their families and their church members and the people, their friends and neighborhoods, how they've heard them talk about someone else who has HIV. The "I don't have that," or "what did they do to get it," or "they need to get away from me," that kind of attitude stops you from sharing. Because you don't want your family, you don't want your mother, you don't want your sister to look at you in the same way that you have seen them look at you, look at others. You don't want them to look at you that way. So that is one thing that I would strongly encourage people to do. Find ways to talk about HIV. Find ways to educate yourselves about HIV. In the previous interview that I did this morning, Dr. Cora talked about the distress that people have from being cut off and from worrying about who do I tell and how do I tell and how are they going to react when I do. That stress can cause problems in your body, and it can exacerbate having HIV. So it's very important for all of us, because if you know someone, if you love someone, if you are someone who is living with HIV, this series is for you. And I don't think I left anyone out. I think it's for everyone. And the first thing we have to do is find ways to talk about it when there's not a crisis. Talk about it when it's not World AIDS Day. Talk about it when it's not sitting and hurting in front of us, so that it becomes a connection. We become a possibility for people if and when they find out that they are HIV positive. Because you see, our attitudes are very important. And they're important to most important to the people that we love and who love us. Because if we have an attitude that doesn't accept a particular person, we might be talking to our son or our daughter who is just like that person. I see it with sexuality as well. We have young people who would rather leave their homes than say that they are gay or lesbian or transgender. They would rather leave home. And they get that way, and they have that reaction because of how they have heard what they have heard in their homes first, how they have been treated for being different. And I talk a lot of times about my daughter and my grandson, and how he went through a stage where he enjoyed carrying a pocketbook and wearing high heels. And my daughter took it all in stride. But there are kids who don't have that kind of accepting environment, because the nature of children is to explore. And when they get that message over and over and over and over, that you can't, first of all, you can't explore unless it's within a certain realm of what's good. And secondly, if you're a little different and you don't fit in, then we're going to do something about it and you might not like it. So the kids would rather leave, and that puts them at risk for HIV, because they're out there today, right at this moment. There are young people out there. So one of the things that I would strongly encourage people who are listening and who will listen to this show, first of all, thank you for listening. More and more of you are listening, and I really appreciate your attention, because time is precious. And every minute that you spend listening to one of my shows, I know it's a gift. But I would strongly encourage people to, if nothing else, we're coming up on the end of a year. If nothing else, with the year 2010 coming in, make a commitment to find ways to talk about something that is difficult. It doesn't have to be HIV. I'd rather it be HIV, because that would have the largest impact, I think, on the largest group of people, including you. But it doesn't have to be. It could be anything that is difficult. Just practice that. Let's stop running away from the things that are hard and difficult to talk about. And as we stop running ourselves and create a space for ourselves to think about and talk about difficult issues, we then become a resource. And we then become a safe place and a safe person for someone else to come and talk about what is difficult for them. So it, just like HIV spreads from one person to the next, one at a time, so can we stop it? One person, one person, one person at a time. When it's not a crisis, when it's where it is, living among us, right in our neighborhoods, right where we are. And it looks like Thomas made it.
Yes, so, here I am.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Sorry I was delayed.
No problem. Glad to have you.
You just said a wonderful message. I'm so glad I got to listen to a couple of minutes of it.
Well, I am glad you're here, and thank you for that. One of the reasons that I wanted to have you here, there are so many reasons. You do fantastic work, and I'm not just saying that. I don't say that lightly. But one of the reasons that I wanted to have you and to talk with you is because you have really pushed the envelope about talking about HIV. And you started with yourself. And I would love to hear your story.
I'd like to start by saying I never intended to end up this way.
Of course.
As in an activist, it just kind of fell into my lap. And I think anybody in an equal situation would probably say the same thing. It's not, you don't sit there when you're a kid going, oh, I want to be an AIDS activist.
No.
And I had a boyfriend pass away in 95. It was a horrible death, as they were then. He was very lucky because it was only 6 months of horrible. It wasn't many years of. We had an amazing love. And I'll be forever grateful for his presence. And I learned an awful lot from him and from that experience. And when you have to fight for someone you love when they're not, when they're in pain like that and when no one knows what's going on, you see strengths in you come out that you didn't know you had because you never had to use them before.
Exactly.
Then several years later, when I was diagnosed, I was actually living in fear for a while because I didn't have insurance. I worked for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and got insurance. And on the form, it says, have you ever been treated for HIV and AIDS? Well, I could honestly say no.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sat and waited for a year because I didn't want them to take it away from me.
Yeah.
And because I was so scared of them hitting me with pre-existing. So, you know, get a policy one day, next day, all of a sudden you got full-blown AIDS. They're going to yank it. I just kept getting sicker. So by the time I went to seek treatment, I was very, very ill. And I went into the emergency room, and the doctor had said, you know, you had like 2-3 days left to live if you'd stay home.
Mm.
And that's very sobering. I was in immense amounts of pain. I could barely function. But you're not in a position to make good choices because you're not getting enough oxygen to your brain, basically. Not enough is working well. And I was a very lucky person, whereas everything they gave me, I responded to and responded to well without side effect and without a time lag. There was another gentleman similar to my story that came in the same night and ended up in the ICU, and I never found out whatever happened to him. But within 24 hours, I was changed. I stayed 12 days, put on 20 pounds. They'd never seen anything like this before. Like, you should not have improved this much. And then the next 5 years were still getting on my feet. There was a lot of, they thought I was going to go blind. I couldn't walk. My neuropathy, which is intense pain and tingling and burning in the hands and feet, side effect from the drugs, was uncontrollable for several months. But after about 5 years, they finally tricked things up and gave me the right stuff, and everything worked. And within like 4 days, it just fell right into place. Within 4 days, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have a future. Because
mm-hmm.
I didn't think I was going to have one. And when you don't think you're going to have one, you don't plan for it.
Yeah.
You're very, very in survival mode day to day. And you're like, well, why plan for my 60s when I'm not going to live to 45? And then that all changed, and then I had this look, this vision for my life, like, okay, wow, I'm going to have that future, and oh, God, my life is a lunar landscape. I got a lot of cleaning up to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you start that process to get ready for your future and, you know, taking care of things I neglected, stuff like that. But about 2 months later, I end up in San Antonio. PR firm hired me to go to work an event for the San Antonio AIDS Foundation, and they weren't able to send somebody. I was freelance, so I said, okay, I got 4 days in San Antonio. It's a paid vacation. Somebody else is paying me to eat and sleep. Great. And I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I'm in Texas. I've got this negative attitude. It's Texas. It turned out to be this life-changing moment. And within a day, I'm like, these people are amazing. This town is beautiful.
Yep.
I didn't see this coming. And They did not take me to the foundation. They kept introducing me to people that worked with the foundation in my hotel, at press conferences, at various meetings and stuff. But I had not seen the foundation, so it wasn't until on day three they said, okay, why don't you come by the foundation? We'll send somebody for you and see what we do. I'm like, sure, okay. And I have my, of course, preconceived notion. I'm a guy in L.A., and I see this building in my head, glass, steel, whatever, foundation. You know, it's supposed to be very fancy. And the car pulls up, and I said, are you sure you're at the right address? And they said, yeah. I said, wait, this looks like a beat-up old nursing home. What are you doing? Hmm. And then I saw on the wall that it said San Antonio AIDS Foundation. I went, oh, my God. Hmm. It wasn't until that moment that I realized how very myopic my view of AIDS had become. Because of dealing with L.A. and New York, mm-hmm. we're very lucky. It's the center of the action. Then you leave those two cities, and with the exception of San Francisco, it's downhill. Mm. There's a big, big lapse at that point. Mm-hmm. San Antonio, seventh largest city in the country, and I am seeing this situation. I walk into the foundation, I'm overwhelmed with emotion. Mm. And it was a nursing home from the 50s. Mm. And they were doing the best they could with it.
Yes.
Because they have 2,000 clients, but their budget is $1.8 million a year.
Wow.
So that's like pennies. Mm. And they had just lost some grant money, so they were scrambling. Mm. And people were taking furlough days because volunteer days instead of pay days to make ends meet because they loved the organization. And I'm with the crowd that I'm supposed to, you know, being introduced with, and I see these people in various stages of disability. Having just come off of 2 months prior thinking I was going to be dead any day now, mm-hmm. these people, in spite of their disabilities, are very much alive. And some of them can't walk, some can't see out of both eyes, some can't talk that well. The problem in San Antonio is because of the Latin culture and Texas conservatism, people are very, very late to care. Mm. So they show up at the hospital and they're knocking on death's door, much like I did.
Yeah.
Except they don't have insurance. They don't have families with money. They're not in LA. They're not connected like I am. And it ripped open my eyes to see just how lucky I was. And the sincerity level, something I don't see much in L.A., was incredible. And I vowed to them at that point. I said, whatever you need me to do. I realized right then and there, I am a very lucky person. Mm. And I have a lot of advantages. Even when I was sick, I had a lot of advantages. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know it. It was very AIDS 1991. It's like I'd step back in a time warp. And, yeah, and to see people like that, it's like, we don't see that in L.A., but yet there are still dying here in L.A., it's just in the neighborhoods that you don't go in, so to speak. And it's not getting the press coverage that it had gotten. Mm-hmm. So I started this, you know, whatever I could do for them, hook them up with this, hook them up with that, came up with this idea to get them Christmas goodie bags, because I'm a celebrity publicist, and I see these celebrities who don't need anything, can't appreciate anything, for the most part, not all of them, mm-hmm. get all this free stuff. Well, how much free shampoo can one head need yeah. in a month?
True.
You know, and it's somewhat, it's excessively gross. And I'm like, you know, let me see if I can pull off this idea to get these people Christmas goodie bags. I only need 30 items mm-hmm. because I only have 30 residents there. I wasn't going to go for the whole $2,000. I was just going to go with the people that were actually in their hospice. And let me see if I can do it. And my plea was a very, very simple one. I said, you're not going to get press. You're only going to make 30 people's Christmas better this year. Mm-hmm. They will not live to see next Christmas. Their families have either disowned them or are too poor to provide for them. And the foundation can only do so much. And I said, I know you got 30 items of your product sitting on your desk. I want you to give them to me. I will come and get them. I will figure out a way to get my hands on them. I want, and whatever makes sense to send, let's send.
Mm-hmm.
Within an hour after sending this email, thinking, okay, I want 5 items per person. That's my goal. It should take me about a month to pull off.
Mm-hmm.
Within an hour, I had commitments for 10 items per person. I hadn't started following up on any of them.
That's great.
And blew me away, and it gave me courage to approach 1-800 Flowers, Whole Foods, other corporations, and got some big guns involved. I'm like, well, this is clearly easier than it should be, so let's go.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning, 22 hours after I sent the email, this woman from the New York Times calls me, and I'm like, yeah? And she's like, yeah, well, we're calling about this this project. I'm like, how did you hear about it? Because I didn't send it there. I didn't. You know, why am I going to send it to the media? It wasn't designed to get media.
Exactly.
And she said, well, this email's making the rounds. And I went, oh, my God, you're kidding. And she's like, just look, I just need the guy's name at the foundation. Because I was being difficult. I just couldn't believe she did this. And I said, well, I'm that guy. Now, it was her turn to be perplexed. She's like, what's an L.A. publicist doing with a project in San Antonio for an AIDS foundation? What's the connection? Then I told her my story.
Mm-hmm.
And she said they were going to do this article on unsung heroes in the fight against HIV that were not celebrities. She didn't want to focus on celebrities. She wanted to focus on real people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really funny. An anti-celebrity moment turns into this. And I gave this article, sent a picture, signed the waiver, yada, yada, yada. Had no idea, didn't want to know what it was going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And my friends were like, did you say your status? I'm like, you have to say your status. It doesn't make sense any other way. You have to understand why I'm doing this. I'm not just like some kind, uninvolved person. It's like I went there, got scared out of my drawers, and realized how lucky I was, and hence I moved. And December 1st, 2006 is when it all changed, and I was one of 5 people they named, and we each had 2,000 words in the New York Times.
Hmm.
And my phone didn't stop ringing for 2 weeks.
Hmm. Well, here's one thing I would want to do. I need to do 2 things, and we're going to come back because I want to keep talking, okay?
Mm-hmm.
One thing I need to do is let people know who are listening live that you're going to lose the show in about 2 minutes, but we will have the entire show for free download on iTunes and my website. And we need to take a 1 minute break, and we will be right back.
Isn't that John and Rachel over there?
I thought they broke up.
Broke up? When?
A while back. John looks good.
Why wouldn't he? Who told you they broke up?
Rachel did.
Well, maybe she was just talking, venting.
No, Rachel found that John had HIV, and she was going to leave him.
What? HIV?
Yeah, she was worried that she had it too, but her test came back negative.
I wonder what made her change her mind. Maybe...
What?
Well, when my brother told me he had HIV, he gave me a book. Said it would help us talk. You remember. The title was Your Neighbor Has AIDS.
Oh yeah, I read that too.
And when Rachel told me about John, I asked her not to make any decisions until she'd read it.
That was smart. That book helped you and your brother.
Yeah, and what I learned helped me talk with Mom, too.
You think that made a difference for them?
I'd bet money on it, and you know I'm not a betting woman.
But you are a great sis and good friend.
Your Neighbor Has AIDS by Deborah E. Lake is available at DeborahELake.com, Amazon.com, and select bookstores.
Okay, we are back, and we are talking with Thomas DiLorenzo. And you were telling us about how you got into telling people how they can help. So.
I fell into it with this project that was never intended to get me media,
mm-hmm.
but it got me media, and it was I had part of the reason why I delayed my health care was because I was scared people were going to leave me.
Yeah.
I was scared I was going to be left alone.
Yeah.
But then you get to a point where, like, it's survival, so I took care of myself. And the more people I told, the more respect I got for telling them.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people know that a lot of people have it and just aren't fessing up to it. And some people, you know, it's a little more obvious than others. You know, you go away for a 2-week stay at a hospital. Nobody stays in a hospital for 2 weeks anymore.
Mm-hmm.
you know, for pneumonia. It's a heavy duty problem. You're lying about what's really going on. And the New York Times piece solidified that I had the courage, like I said, this was never my plan, to say this in the New York Times. And I got calls from friends of mine in the media, the phone voice people that you deal with all the time, but you don't know what they look like. Mm-hmm. And friends of mine at USA Today and various other places in New York, other media sources were like, wow, this is a really beautiful article in New York Times, and you had the nerve to come out. And by that point, it had been like a non-issue to me. Because mm-hmm. part of it was like, once you tell your mom, it's all downhill from there. It doesn't matter who else knows. That's the hardest person to tell.
Yes.
And then everybody else is easy. So now I'm like incredibly vocal about it just simply because it's a part of who I am. And I see people holding back on it, and it doesn't do them any good.
Mm-hmm.
It's the new closet, mm-hmm. and we need to be more honest to each other because it will help all of us. We need to do it because people need to realize that it's still a problem, that it's not just taking a pill.
Mm-hmm.
It's a problem. We're losing funding due to budget cuts. Prevention is going first. I'm scared what it's going to do to the younger generation.
Yeah.
We still have maintained our Ryan White funding, but by a bare minimum increase.
Mm.
As more and more people become HIV positive and then full-blown AIDS and require the treatments, it's pennies per person now.
Mm-hmm.
The drugs are not cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have people on waiting lists in this country to get the drugs. We're the wealthiest nation to ever exist on this planet, and we have citizens that we cannot take care of.
I know, yeah. And in different parts, like you're pointting out so well, different parts of the country, the disparity is striking.
Yeah.
Everywhere you go.
And it's about to – the cool thing about the recession is it's the great equalizer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As California starts – because our ADAP policy is going to change in March, and I'm scared for my drugs, and most of mine are covered by my health insurance. My co-payments are covered by the state of Cal through their ADAP program. So I need to make sure my financial house is in order before that March moment comes, just in case I don't qualify anymore, because no one's really saying anything because they're really avoiding making that statement.
Mm.
But it's people in California, people in New York. It's not just people in South Dakota or Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
We had Alabama, South Carolina, Mississippi. Their HIV populations have exploded because the industry in that state is prison-related. And as they let these people out of prisons, uneducated, without any guidance, they just go into the general population, and they literally walk up to the local Rite Aid and say, where are my drugs? Because they don't have a clue. They were not told.
Mm-hmm.
And so their ADAP lists in those states are incredible. South Carolina had 5 people die 2 years ago waiting to get drugs.
Wow. That's
criminal.
That's unacceptable. It really is. And hopefully this will help. One of the things I want to do is, you touched on so much, but I want to really hone in on one particular thing. You said it when you told your mother, your family,
mm-hmm.
the rest was okay.
Yeah.
Talk to the person who just can't get to that point, because one of the things that I know is until you tell the people that you go to for support and the people that you respect and love and who you want their love and respect, you are carrying around and you're isolating yourself. You're carrying around something that has 2 and 3 times the impact in your life, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to that person. What would you say to someone who was sitting there and I can't tell my sister. I just can't. I can't tell my mom.
I thought that they were not going to be there for me.
Yeah.
For a variety of reasons. But I didn't think they would be supportive and would cut me loose. And I had enormous guilt
mm-hmm.
for getting this. And you do, you know. But I reached a point where I couldn't. It was kind of funny. I'm in the hospital Wednesday night, and I figured, oh, I'll just take my cell phone. So when we play the caller ID game, they'll just think it's calling from my cell phone, and they won't know I'm in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, I'm having difficulty breathing, and I'm hooked up to a few machines. I forgot those were to be in the background, but never mind about those. So I figured I could outgame her by this. Well, mom's got that little LoJack in you that senses when problems go on.
Yeah.
And my mother's LoJack apparently went off big. Because they had seen me 2 weeks before Christmas, and I was 132 pounds. I should be 155 to 160.
Mm-hmm.
That's average weight for a person my size.
Mm-hmm.
So I was skeletal, and I had classic spiking fevers, and could eat, couldn't eat, was exhausted, wasn't. I was classic. And this is Christmas 2000.
Mm-hmm.
So when she didn't hear from me, because she would call me all the time, she thought I'd killed myself.
Mm.
She tells me later. So I don't check messages, because I'm a little busy in the hospital, until noon my time. And I gotten a 7 o'clock message from my mom, an 8 o'clock message, a 9 o'clock message. And then I got the 10 o'clock message from what I call the cavalry, my sister.
Mm.
And I'm like, oh, no. I thought I could fake my way through this. I don't know how the hell they know.
Mm.
So I call my mom. I leave a message. Didn't get her. I call my brother and just start randomly calling because I have a brother and sister and mom and dad. And he was incredibly supportive.
Mm.
And then when I told my dad, he said the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. Because I apologized to him for doing this to him. And he said, it's not happening to us. It's happening to you.
Mm-hmm.
You have nothing to be sorry for.
Yeah.
And that just erased everything in the past at that point. Then my sister gets on the phone. This is funny. And I'm sitting in the hospital room, and I talk to two of them. I'm on my way to go in number three, and I said, Dana, I'm in the hospital. I have AIDS. And she's like, no, you're not. I'm like, what? No, you're kidding. You always joke. You're kidding. Oh, come on. Do you think I'd be this tasteless? Come on. I'm fairly tasteless, but I'm not this tasteless. Please. And I can't believe my sister, who's the coolest one, is having difficulty with this, but I'm calling her at work, and she's a social worker at the time, and then it finally sunk in that I would not be going this far.
Hmm.
And she asked, like, how are you doing? And I just, well, so far so good. I seem to be responding, you know, but I was in bad shape. Then my mom calls me, and she's driving. I'm like, call me back when you're stable, situated. Yeah. No, tell me now. Because she knew. She knew. She was just grateful to hear my voice, but she knew this was not going to be good news.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother's driving on the freeway in her BMW. I'm scared things are going to happen when I tell her. I said, okay, I'm in the hospital and I have AIDS. I have pneumocystis, pneumonia, and thrush, and I'm not in good shape. And she simply said, okay, before I ask any questions, I've got to get this out of my system, and you will never hear it again.
Mm.
Oh, my God, how could you be so stupid? You saw David die. How could you do this to yourself? Okay, out of my system.
Mm.
Okay, and then she went into mother mode. And I'm like, well, you're entitled to say that, you know, because you're my mother. You should respond like that. How could I be this stupid, and how could I?
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought she was legit. And they have stepped up to the plate in ways that I never saw possible before. They have so been there for me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've had to educate them. I gave a talk at NYU, and people said, well, you know, I'm from Tanzania, and nobody listens. I'm like, because you have to keep saying it.
Mm-hmm.
It may take 10 times, it may take 100 times, it may take 1,000 times, but you have to keep saying it. And eventually they hear it. Mm-hmm. And then they respond to it, and then they're there. They're not going to hear it the first time because they don't want to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've told them the worst news I could possibly tell them. You know, I'm your child, and I could be dead.
Mm-hmm.
But once that was all over with, because that was a lot of guilt I was carrying, it took 1,000 pounds off my shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to be honest and truthful with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they could ask questions from an uninformed point of view. They had not seen it up close and in person.
Mm-hmm.
They were not here when my boyfriend died, so they did not. They only know the horror stories they hear from TV.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a lot of misconceptions. And it was my job to educate them.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents initially said, "We're not telling anyone." And I said, "Okay, you know, you live there. You don't want your friends to know. It's not for me to say that, but I live here and people know. So I live in Los Angeles. They live in upstate New York."
Mm-hmm.
Flash forward several years later, in comes Facebook. And everybody I know is on Facebook. I have 4,500 friends on Facebook. And they include in-laws of my sister. So now I blog for the Huffington Post and a site called thebody.com.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very open about what I go through on my blogging.
Mm-hmm.
And they read it. These people that I see once a year at Christmas are reading it, and then all of a sudden they're responding. So now everybody knows that mom and dad didn't want to know. And they're way cool about it. And it's the same kind of thing that happened with the New York Times, that the more people you tell, the more respect you get for telling it, because they realize this is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're going through is not easy. It's not going to be easy. No matter how healthy I am, it's not easy to go to the doctors every 3 months to get those numbers, because you're so scared they're going to change.
Mm-hmm.
But numbers are just numbers. And how you feel is what matters. And my parents are my biggest supporters now. When I spoke at NYU, my mom, oh, God, it was so funny. She's like, "Oh, this is great. You're speaking at NYU and AIDS in Africa." And I'm like, "Where is my mother and what have you done to her? You want your child to go and speak publicly?" "No, you do a good job with it. Go." And I'm like, "Oh, my God, somebody's grown up."
So what I hear you saying is that you became empowered.
Yes.
And it was a healing process.
Yeah.
To actually talk with the people that you love and care about. And it was important for them to be able to have their reactions, ask whatever questions they needed to ask. So it's like a two-way conversation.
Yeah.
Constantly back and forth. And I think that's what a lot of people are afraid of, that two-way conversation.
It is very empowering. Now mom and dad send me articles and, you know, "Oh, this new cure," and they follow it closer than I do now. It's kind of funny. And they're ecstatic at what has happened, that I've taken this really, really horrible situation,
mm-hmm,
and turned it into something so good.
Mm-hmm.
Or as I like to say, who knew so few T cells could do so much?
Mm-hmm.
They're very proud of what I've done with it. 8 years ago, when I was in denial, I wouldn't have said that.
Mm-hmm.
I would not have seen that coming.
Well,
but you've got to make the step.
Yeah, and that's the hardest. That really is the hardest.
It is, and you have to make. I'm dating someone now, and his mother doesn't take his disease as seriously as he would like, or his HIV status.
Mm-hmm.
And knock on wood, he's just positive and hasn't had any problems. But he'd like more support from his mom, and I'm like, you got to keep talking to her. You
mm-hmm.
just have to keep bringing it up, and you literally have to say, "I need this from you."
Exactly, because sometimes we don't know until we're told.
Oh, yeah,
like
for whatever reason, and they're not necessarily avoiding the conversation. It's a hard one to have for both people.
Mm-hmm. It is.
But once you break through that wall, it's very easy. And it's kind of funny. Like, I dated one guy last year, and his friends read my column. I'm like, oh, you're that guy that writes about the Huffington Post. You're the guy that writes about HIV. And I'm like, oh, this is funny. And these were people in Omaha, Nebraska. So I really didn't see this coming. And I've gotten it's been a cool thing. I mean, do I wish I took another route to get here? Oh, very much so. But I like where I am, and it took that first step.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got to take that first step, and you just got to build up the courage and just jump. It's like jumping in the deep end of the pool when you know the water's cold. You know, it's going to hurt for a minute, but then you'll be fine.
And the other thing that I know is the when we're facing a crisis like that and life-changing situations like that, we tend to look at what we didn't do, what we wish we had done, what we don't have now, what we can't do now. And one of the things I liked about your story is you turned it around and focused on what you could do and what you did have and what you do have.
Yeah.
And used it. And that's what I want people to hear, that no matter where you are in your life, you have something. You have something.
I am very, very blessed with a lot of very wonderful people in my life that I can turn to for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very blessed with a family that's very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And it took HIV to make me realize that.
Mm-hmm.
The universe works in ways, strange ways, and this apparently was supposed to be my path.
Mm-hmm.
Once the ball started to get in motion, it just got easier, and more things happened. And I'm not recommending everyone go in the New York Times and announce their status, but just the little things. And the telling your friends, telling your close neighbors, telling your family. You'll be surprised at their positive reaction.
Yeah, and this is the time of year when families want to get closer. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, all of Hanukkah, different holidays are kind of packed right in this time frame. And this is a possibility where you can give each other a gift that doesn't require that you pay for it the rest of the year.
Yeah.
You can give a gift of your honesty and your presence and your caring and your vulnerability, being vulnerable to another person and trusting. That's a wonderful gift.
It's as scary as it seems to do it, it's so much better, and you feel so much better for it on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's funny when people don't know, because I'm so out about it. I'm like, you didn't know? How did you miss that? You know. But now, like, my entire family knows. Cousins, aunts, uncles, everybody. And everybody's really cool about it. And I would not have given them that much credit 10 years ago. We don't give people as much credit as they do because of our own fears.
Exactly.
And they're actually a lot more on the ball, stronger with it than we give them credit for, because we take it away from them because we are seeing them through our fear.
Exactly. That is so, if you don't take anything else away from this show, take that one.
Thank you.
We see our families and the people that we care about through our fear. That is,
yeah.
That is so important to understand. Well, I want to thank you. Thank you so
thank
much
you.
For being here and for being so candid and sharing so much information that I'm sure will help many people as they go through their life process. I really appreciate you being here.
Thanks a lot. It was an honor.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
All right, take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye. That's all I have for you today. Thanks for listening. This is All the Way In for Friday, November the 6th. And I'm Deborah Lake, here to let you know that you can recognize, claim, and live fully in your life. Until next time, world. Today, thanks for listening, and remember to live all the way in your life. Until next time, stay connected. Visit DeborahELake.com. And while you're there, sign up to follow on Twitter and Facebook. You'll also be able to download previously recorded programs. And sign up to become a member and get your edition of the brand new All the Way In newsletter. Members also have access to follow-up broadcasts and special discounts. Remember that you can take All the Way In wherever you go through iTunes. If you have any questions or comments, send an email to allthewayin@deborahelake.com. I'd love to hear from you. All the Way In is a production of Lake Enterprise.